I go for the refuge of the light and light, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints, from the virtues that I collect,
by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings.
May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness.
May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering.
May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless.
May all dwell in equanimity,
free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents, ornaments by the sun and the moon. Visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure land. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariva Ratnamandala Pudzamega Samudra Saparan Samaye. Okay, welcome to this beautiful ornament of the three visions. You know, I was thinking before class just how incredible it is what the Sakyas did with Lamdre, because it was, there was nothing written down before. There was only just a very short little, one little picture, cryptic notes for hundreds of years. It was all oral. And then the Sakya founders came along, and Sachin Kung Ningbo, right off the bat, he wrote 11 commentaries, which is pretty amazing if you think about it. And then for hundreds of years, commentaries and various, we didn't go into a lot of the detail, but there were a lot of sort of branches that went out like this, and then they came back together again eventually. And hundreds of years of scholarly commentary and practitioners with great realizations. And they expanded it so that now people like us can have access to it. But they also did the opposite. They condensed it. They condensed it down into two parts, this whole thing in two parts, you know, the preliminary and the actual practice. If you think about that, that's pretty amazing too, to go in the expansion direction and also in the contraction direction to make it accessible. It's really amazing to me, anyway.
It's amazing too to learn how many Jetsunmas there were involved in vital stages of the transmission through the centuries.
So we have our foundation with our faith and our refuge for our high rise. And now we're starting to build the first floor. So just to reorient ourselves where we are. So we know the three visions. What are the three visions? What are they called?
The impure
vision. Yeah, the impure vision. And then?
Vision of experience.
Vision of experience. And then?
Pure vision.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So who has the impure vision?
We do.
Okay. What's the idea when we practice? We're in the practice section now. So when we practice the section on the impure vision, what are we trying to develop there? What's the idea?
Motivation to leave it behind.
Yeah. And what's one word that summarizes that?
Renunciation.
We're doing that practice in the impure vision. That's what we're developing. Then when we get into the vision of experience, what are we developing? Remember we said there's different kinds of prayers? There's supplication.
Aspiration,
yeah. So in the vision of experience, we're developing aspiration. Okay? And then when we get to the pure vision, what are we developing? Developing enthusiasm. And Lama defined that as being completely interested in Dharma. So if we've done renunciation, we've done aspiration, then we're ready for that. So anyway, if you want to review that, if you want to check your cups, your three cups, that's page 19. And so then we start the instructions of the impure vision to produce renunciation. And there's three parts to that. First one is, just to remind ourselves, the faults of worldly existence. All right, we're on page 20. And then next one is the instruction on the difficulty of obtaining the prerequisites, more commonly known as the precious human rebirth. These 18 prerequisites that we have mentioned several times, but we haven't covered yet, but we will. We'll get to that. And that's really important. And then the third one is what's to be accepted and what's to be rejected. In other words, what's virtuous and what's non-virtuous, which may sound obvious, but when we get into that, we'll see if it's all necessarily obvious. So right now, we're still in part A, which is the faults of the worldly existence to produce renunciation. So that's kind of a summary of where we've come to this point. And last time we did a journey through the cold hells. And tonight we're going to start with the hot hells. So we're on the bottom of page 25 if you have a book that you're following. And we have eight hot hells. So, who would like to start reading for us?
I will.
Okay.
Start with two, the hot hells.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The eight hot hells are, and as it was said in the scripture, the reviving, the black line, the crushing, the wailing, the great wailing, the hot, the greatly hot, and the unceasing. These are the eight hot hells. The reviving hell. This is a place of birth where the ground of burning iron is pervaded by a greatly blazing fire. The hell being upon whom the result of his own former deeds has befallen has a miraculously born, large, full-sized body with a low endurance for heat and fear. Just by being born there, the thought arises through the power of the unhappy mind that, alas, oh, I am born into a place like this. It would be well were no others to harm me in this place. As if this thought were the cause, very powerful and fearful attendants of the Lord of Death, carrying various weapons, come from all possible directions. Just as hunters corner and kill a deer, so the hell being is tormented by the hell attendants by being spontaneously beaten, cut, and pierced many times with weapons. Finally, one experiences a short death or unconsciousness. However, due to the power of one's previous deeds of karma, the sound, revive, is heard from the sky, and a wind strikes the body which causes one to be restored as before. Once again, one is tortured by the attendants of death. One experiences this uninterruptedly again and again. As it was said in the Bodhicaryavatara, having performed many unwholesome deeds, they suffer by being tormented through having their skin stripped off by the attendants of the Lord of Death, by having molten copper melted by the flames of the greatly hot hell poured onto their bodies, by being pierced by fiery swords and spears, by having their flesh sliced into 100 pieces, and by falling upon a fiercely blazing iron floor.
Okay, thank you.
That doesn't scare the bejesus out of you.
So that's the reviving hell, the first one. And then we go to the black line hell. I'll read that. The experience of this hell is similar to the previous one, but in addition, many black lines are drawn on the body of the hell being who is born there by the attendants of the Lord of Death. Just as carpenters do with wood, so the attendants saw along the lines with sharp, blazing saws. Also, one experiences pain caused by this act and having one's body split by sharp axes. As it was said in Letter to a Friend by Nagarjuna, some are cut by saws, likewise, others are split by terribly sharp axes. So that's the second one, the black line hell. Does somebody want to read the next one?
I will.
Okay.
The crushing hell. Being born upon a ground of burning iron, the hell being is unable to bear the touch of heat. Wishing to flee in any direction, one looks about here and there. Great mountains resembling the faces of yaks, buffaloes, and the like approach and crush one's body in the way that sesame is ground into powder, so that an endless stream of blood flows out. For a while, the two mountains open up, and due to the power of one's karma, one's body resumes its previous shape. Then one again experiences the same suffering as before, as was said in the letter to a friend.
Yeah.
Some are squeezed like sesame. Similarly, others are ground like fine powder.
Okay, there'll be a lot of quotes from a letter to a friend. Nagarjuna went into great detail about this, and so these are the scriptural basis for the text that's being written here. Okay, Lauren, do you feel like reading again?
Sure. The Wailing Cow. Apart from being the same as above, one looks about in all directions and spies a house to which one wishes to flee. One goes while experiencing many heat tortures on top of the ground of burning iron. Finally, one arrives inside the house. The doors close themselves behind one, and due to one's being burned by the blazing flames from every side, there is nothing one can do to escape, to do except to wail as if the sobs were being pulled out from one's very heart.
Okay. And then next is the great wailing hell. Apart from all else being as above, the hell being enters two houses of burning iron, one house placed within another. Since the pains of burning are twofold greater, one's wailing sobs are even louder than before. And then the hot hell. The hell being is caught by the attendants of the Lord of Death, who strongly push up a blazing iron spear through the anus to the crown of the hell being. Thus flames issue out through one's mouth and nose. Does somebody want to read the next one, Stephen? Do you want to read?
The greatly hot hell. One is impaled with a blazing iron trident, which is pushed through the anus and two buttocks, up to the crown and two shoulders. Having been pierced, blood, fat, and flames emerge from one's mouth and ears. As it was said in the... Is that the same one?
Letter to a friend, yeah, same one.
Some are completely transfixed by greatly heated barbed iron spears. The unceasing hell. The hell being's body itself burns as flames in a stove of blazing iron, which is 20,000 leagues in size, and one is tormented constantly by measureless agonies difficult to bear. As it was said in the letters to a friend, as surely as freedom from attachment produces the most excellent happiness among all happiness, so surely the very dreadful suffering of the unceasing hell is the worst among all suffering.
So here Nagarjuna sort of gently reminds us that if you don't want to go through all this, freedom from attachment, in other words, renunciation, is your ticket. He's emphasizing the importance of that. And this indeed is the extremity among the sufferings of worldly existence. So of all of samsara, this last one, the unceasing hell, that is the absolute worst suffering that there is. And His Holiness 41st Sakyatrichan said that it's just as if the person doesn't even exist, it's just suffering. There is they as a being are not even there, they're just pure suffering. It's just beyond description. Beyond comprehension. So now we get to find out how long it lasts. So concerning the lifespan of the hot hells, it's stated in the Armidharma Kosha, Vasubandhu's famous text, 50 years of human life is a single day of the lowest gods of the realms of desire, whereby their lifespan is 500 of their own years, that of the second higher heaven is successively twofold. The life of each of the six heavenly states of the realm of desire is correspondingly equivalent to one day of life in each of the first six hells, such as the reviving hell, and so on. So that's kind of a roundabout way of saying it. He talks about the God realm and then compares it to the hell realm. But in any case, this means that 50 human years is equivalent to one day of life in the lowest heaven, the heaven of the four great kings. 30 of these days is 1 month, and 12 of these months is 1 year. And a god in the heaven of the four great kings lives for 500 of their years, and this is equivalent to one day of life in the reviving hell. Calculating in this manner, reviving hell beings live for 500 of their own years. Similarly, 100 human years is equivalent to one day of life in the second heaven, known as 33, and life in this heaven lasts for 1,000 of their own years. And this is equivalent to one day in the Black Lion Hell. Calculating in this way, beings in the Black Lion Hell live for 1,000 of their own years. 200 human years is equivalent to one day of life in the heaven of freedom from fighting. Life in this heaven lasts for 2,000 of their own years. And this is equivalent to one day in the crushing hell. Calculating in this manner, crushing hell beings live for 2,000 of their own years. So 400 human years is equivalent to one day of life in the heaven of joy, and life in this heaven lasts for 4,000 of their own years. And this is equivalent to one day in the wailing hell. Calculating in this way, they live for 4,000 of their own years. 800 human years is equivalent to one day of life in the heaven of miraculous joy. And life in this heaven lasts for 8,000 of their own years, and this is equivalent to one day in the great wailing hell. Calculating in this manner, they live for 8,000 of their own years. 1,600 human years is equivalent to one day of life in the heaven of empowered by the miracle of others. Life in this heaven lasts for 16,000 of their own years. And this is equivalent to one day in the hot hell. And calculating in this manner, they live for 16,000 of their own years. And life in the greatly hot hell lasts for half an intermediate eon, and for a complete intermediate eon in the unceasing hell. So to summarize this, 500, 1,000, 2,000, 4,000, 800, 8,000, 16,000, half an intermediate eon, and an intermediate eon are gradually applied to the eight hot hells. So there's a lot of numbers and calculating there, but it gives you some idea of just how unbelievably long these lives are, but not only in the hell realm, but also in the God realm. And this becomes important later on when we discover or read about the suffering of the God realms, which on the surface looks like they've got it made, but they haven't. So just you might want to keep that in mind, and I think that's maybe why they made these comparisons here with the heavenly realms. The next paragraph goes into how to practice this. So remember when we first started, we talked about listening, contemplating, meditation, and using this as a guidebook. So you get the lesson, you get the scriptural references, and then you get a suggestion about how you can actually do the practice on this. So would somebody like to read that for us?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The way to reflect on the meaning of this is to do the preliminaries as before. Then one should produce a desire to practice religion and generate the following thought. Alas, this world of existence is burning, greatly burning, very greatly burning. Within this, the beings of the hot hells possess such a place, such a nature, and such lifespans. If now I cannot bear even the feeling of pain caused by the touch of just a tiny weapon or a small flame against my body, how shall I bear it if such agonies of the hot hells befall me? The neighboring
hell... Just 1 second, please. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm just reminded of one of the teachers, one of the Sakya teachers, Desheng Rinpoche, whose guru did a 15-year retreat, if you can imagine. And he spent the first year just on renunciation. Just to get in the mood, I guess. But it's really important, and they're really kind of driving it home. But if all of those hells weren't enough, we also have the neighboring hells and the minor hells. So the neighboring hells and the minor hells are as follows. The neighboring hells are the fire trench, the mud of putrid corpses, the path of blades, the forest of swords, Shamali trees, and the river. As was said in the Abhidharmakosha, on each of the four sides of the hot hells are found the fire trench hell, the mud of putrid corpses hell, the path of blades hell, and others in the river hell. Thus, there are 16 neighboring hells. Okay, would somebody else like to read?
Sure, I will. Described as existing around the whole periphery of the eight hot hells are, in each of the four directions, the six neighboring hells, which consist of the four explicitly named ones and the two extra hells, the Forest of Sword hell and the Shamali Trees hell, which are indicated in the verse by and the others. Even though the karma of experiencing the major hells has been exhausted, still one must experience each of these neighboring hells in the four directions. The manner in which these hells are experienced is as follows. The hell being, on being released from those main torments, thinks, I must escape to some other happier region and stay there. Very quickly going off in any direction, say the east, one first encounters a fearful pit filled with embers. One thinks, here is a pleasant plain, and without hesitating, one begins to cross it. One's body sinks to the top of the head, and all of one's flesh, skin and flesh, are seared, producing an agony that penetrates to the bones. On being released from there, one spies something that looks like some dirty water. Since one was afflicted by the great heat, one enters it with the hope that it will cool one. One's whole body sinks and the water transforms itself into bad-smelling, dirty, putrid mud. Worms dwelling in that place with yellow bodies and black heads cause agony by piercing one's body here and there and eating through to the marrow. On emerging from there, one sees something like a green meadow. Going there, it transforms itself into a great path filled with razor blades. Wherever one places one's feet, they are slashed, so that, unable to bear the touch of that pain, one loses one's balance and falls down. One experiences the pain of one's entire body being cut. On being released from there, one spies a great mountain, thinks, I should stay there for a while. On arriving, winds arise which shake the trees fiercely. The leaves snap off from their branches and descend. They change into a rain of swords, and one experiences the pain of having one's body cut into pieces. On being released from there, one spies a great mountain where, when one arrives at its foot, one is torn apart by the fearful dogs of hell. Though one utters terrible great laments, there is no one at all to protect one. Finally, the dogs cut and tear one's entire body into pieces so that one experiences the pain of being reduced to mere remnants. At that time, one hears at the top of the mountain the sound of some male or female person who had formerly been an object of attachment, calling down to one. While climbing up to this mountain, all the flesh of one's body is destroyed by the down-pointed iron thorns of the Shamali trees, which cover the slopes of the entire mountain. Reaching the mountaintop, one does not see the object of attachment. Instead, the fearful birds of hell cause manifold injuries, such as plucking out one's eyes, drinking one's brain, ripping open one's belly, and the like. Once again, one hears that object of attachment calling from the foot of the mountain, and one climbs down. The thorns, showing their tips pointed upward, now cut and rend all of one's body as before. As it was said in the letters to the friend, some with hands outstretched towards the sky are overpowered by fierce dogs with iron fangs, while others, powerless, are torn asunder by ravens with terrible sharp claws and sharp iron beaks. Then one's body is restored as before. Wishing to escape elsewhere, one flees. One sees the unfordable river of hot ashes as water. Unhesitatingly, one enters it. One is afflicted by the touch of the river's intense heat, but since the other bank is guarded by the wardens of hell carrying various weapons, one is unable to go ashore. One turns back again, and as if one had been confused concerning directions, comes to the actual place where one left the hot hell before entering the first neighboring hell. Remembering the experience of suffering that intensely afflicted one there, one quickly flees in a southern direction. As before, one is stricken by the suffering of the fire trench hell and the others. Again, one returns to the center. In this way, one must also experience the whole cycle of sufferings in the west and north. Thus it is said that since the three hells, the razor path, the sword forest, and the shamali trees, involve an identical type of weapon, they constitute a single class. So with this one class are added the other three, the fire trench, the putrid, and the river hells, and thus these four multiplied by the four directions give a total of 16 hells.
Okay, thank you. I don't have the translation of this sutra. I won't even attempt to pronounce the name of it, so we'll just say in a sutra it says, each of the eight hot hells has 16 different kinds of neighboring hells. That's just the scriptural reference there. Now reflect upon the suffering of the minor hells. As it was said, the hell being is cooked in great vessels, eats iron chunks, drinks molten bronze, has its tongue plowed by plows, is wrapped into sheets, is bound by chains, and is roasted in burning iron powder. One is cooked in boiling molten bronze in the great vessel of hell, and the wardens of hell feed blazing iron chunks into one's mouth, which one, being helpless, must eat. So too, one must drink boiling molten bronze. One's tongue is stretched about 1 league in length and plowed by plows of burning iron. One is wrapped up in sheets of burning iron, and one's entire body is bound in chains of burning iron. Also, one is roasted together with burning iron powder. Moreover, there are indescribable hells, such as ones which are like pillars, like rows of seats, and like brooms, and hells wherein there is pleasure by day and suffering at night, and others wherein night holds pleasure, but days have suffering. On these occasions, one should narrate, either in the long or short versions, depending on one's times, the stories, and I'm sorry, I don't know these stories, Shranakoti. Anybody know Shranakoti's story? No? Okay. Going to the ocean shore. Sakitrijan said that sometimes people who have a type of occupation where they commit certain non-virtues at night, but then they're a model citizen during the day, they have this kind of alternating hell experience where they have a nighttime hellish experience, and then during the day they just have a sort of normal experience, or vice versa.
Do they remember that night hell during the day?
I don't know. Thus, even the very greatest sufferings of the human realm cannot become an example of even the slightest of the agonies of the hells. As was said in a letter to a friend, the sufferings which one sustains from violent thrusts by 300 spears in one day in this world cannot even be compared to a fraction or a small fraction of hell's suffering.
I don't even know if a body could handle 300 spears.
Yeah. So now we're going to find out what causes this kind of karma.
That was going to be my next question. Avoid it like the plague.
Laurel, would you like to read for us?
Sure. It may be asked, from what cause do these sufferings arise? They arise due to the affliction of hatred. Therefore, those who wish well-being for themselves should train in giving up anger. As was said in the Bodhicaratta.
Yeah, Shantideva.
If I am unable to bear these minute pains, then why do I not reject anger, which is the cause of hell's suffering?
Yeah, so you notice there, remember a long time ago when we did the three poisons, some of them had slashes? So here you see one of the slashes, hatred / anger. They're the same non-virtue, just different expressions of it. So that's the cause, that's the karmic cause of being thrown into all these hell realms that we just read about. And now comes the the practice section, if you want to do the meditative or contemplative practice, it says, contemplate on the meaning of this as follows. Alas, these painful torments of the hells are extremely unbearable. How can I even look at the great agonies of the hot and cold hells? Realms of the neighboring and minor hells are such, and their lifespan is such. How could I bear it if such suffering of the neighboring and minor hells should befall me? If even now I cannot bear just the prick of a thorn in my body. Thinking in this manner, one should produce a mind which desires to practice religion. Specifically here, we're talking about renunciation, but also in general.
It seems like a good time to say this. When Geshe was teaching love and compassion, somebody asked about compassion for oneself. And he said that was actually, like, there was no such thing as such. And that when one expressed that sentiment toward oneself, it was called renunciation. It seems like a kind of a synonymous term to use to give it the matter some depth.
So to have compassion for oneself is considered renunciation.
Yeah, there is no such thing as compassion for oneself. It is called renunciation. Mm-hmm. The wish to separate oneself from suffering.
Mm-hmm. How do you think he meant that? Can you elaborate on
that? I took it at face value.
Yeah?
I think it means that it's the only, because the practice of Dharma is the only way to happiness. Then, if you want happiness at all, and if you're compassionate to yourself and you want the best for yourself, as you wish for all sentient beings, then you're going to want the key to get out of that, and that's renunciation.
Yeah. And remember, we're building the first floor of our building here, so this renunciation is really fundamental. Mm-hmm. It's not the preliminary, but it's just as important in the sense that if your first floor isn't any good, your building's going to fall. And this renunciation, personally, I think we sort of have renunciation, but we're still not totally clear on this. And I think that's one of the reasons they go into such depth here, pages and pages about renunciation, you know, to get it really clear that there really is no happiness in samsara. Okay, so that concludes the hell realm. Suffering. Now we're going to read about the suffering of the hungry ghosts. And we're still in the lower three realms, though. Okay. And we're still going to get a lot of quotations from Nagarjuna's letter to a friend. Orna, you want to keep reading for us?
Sure. Oh, okay. Did you want to go? No, it's quiet. Okay. As it was said in the letters to a friend, also among hungry ghosts, continuous, unallayed suffering is produced through lack of desired objects. Very terrible sufferings created by hunger, thirst, cold, heat, weariness, and fear will have to be endured. In general, it was said in the
This is the sutra. Close Mindfulness Sutra.
The which?
Close Mindfulness
Close
Sutra.
Mindfulness Sutra. That there are about 36 types of hungry ghosts. But if categorized, there are three. Those with 1, external obscurations, 2, internal obscurations, and 3, the obscuration of obscurations. 1, the hungry ghosts with external obscurations. These have collected a similar type of karma which causes them to be born together in a realm that resembles a tawny-colored blend of sand or pebbles, utterly devoid of water and the light. As it was said in the letters to a friend, some, troubled by hunger, are not able to eat, even a little discarded, coarse, or impure food. For each has a mouth as big as the eye of a needle, and the stomach the size of a mountain. Some, like the upper reaches of a dried palm tree, are naked, with bodies of skin and bones. As it was said, one has a mouth just the size of a needle's eye, a throat as narrow as a horse's tail, limbs as thin as grass stalks, a belly as vast as a mountain, frazzled hair, dried out skin, and flesh molded onto the bones. Thus one resembles the upper reaches of a palm tree. One has no opportunity to dwell at leisure due to one's hunger and thirst. One's body emits groaning sounds and creaks like the pulling of an old cart. Moving about, one's joints rub against each other, causing pain as intense as the blaze of a fire. With many such pains of weariness and fatigue, however much one searches, one does not find food and drink. And even if once in a great while one finds a little, it is guarded by a large number of others who are more powerful than oneself. Carrying weapons, they beat, pelt, and mistreat one in various ways. Not being allowed to eat, one experiences suffering of both body and mind.
Okay, so do you remember we talked in an earlier session about the poor female? They described her as a demoness, but she was compulsive about eating children. Do you remember
right.
that?
Yeah.
Hariti?
Hariti, yeah.
Trungma in Tibetan. She was a hungry ghost. So it's this compulsion to eat and not being able to is a characteristic. Yeah. Lauren, you want to continue?
Sure.
I mean, Laurel, I'm sorry.
Oh, Laurel. Okay. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I got your name wrong.
There's two L's. The hungry ghost with internal obscurations. As it was said in the...
That is called the Letter for Training by Chandra Goman.
Well, his mouth is about the size of a needle's eye. His great belly is pained since it is many leagues in size. Even though he drinks the great ocean's water, it does not enter into the throat's wide cavity. And even a drop of water is dried up by the poison of his breath. On top of those sufferings, one happens to find, through searching with great effort, a trickle of mucus, still due to the power of being habituated to miserliness and avarice since beginningless time. One cannot eat properly. When one begins to eat, the food will not go into the mouth. Even if it enters, it does not go past the throat. Even if it passes through, it is of no benefit on reaching the stomach. For the distress of hunger and thirst becomes greater than before. Thus one experiences the suffering of not being benefited by food and drink.
Okay, so we're given a hint here of what the karma is that creates this. It's stinginess.
Yeah.
Miserliness.
Okay, thank you. And then the third category, which are hungry ghosts with the obscuration of obscurations, as was said in Letter to a Friend, some, with flames nightly issuing from their mouths, devour food of burning sand that has fallen into their mouths. Striking one another's faces, they eat the pus of ripened goiters growing from their throats. So on top of the above sufferings, immediately on devouring a trifling morsel of food, it blazes up into great flames so that the tongues of flame flutter out of one's nose and mouth, and one utters a terrible great noise. One has many sufferings of eating hot sand. One fights the others for food and eats the pus of ripened goiters on one's throat. So not only do they have a hard time finding food and eating it, they also fight each other over it. So there's this constant sort of turmoil in their experience. For all categories of hungry ghosts, even the light of the summer moon causes heat. And that of the winter sun causes cold. The one approaches a fruit-bearing tree or a great river, these dry up when merely looked upon with wishful thoughts of enjoying them. In this way, one has inexpressible suffering. As was said in Letter to a Friend, for them, even the moon is hot in the summer, while even the sun is cold in the winter. Trees become fruitless and rivers dry up if merely looked upon by them. So now we find out how long it lasts. Lorna, do you want to read?
Sure. As it was said in...
Treasury of Knowledge.
Treasury of Knowledge, the hungry ghosts live for 500 years where a day is equal to 1 month. Thus one will live 500 of one's own years wherein one human month is equal to 1 day in the life of hungry ghosts. If calculated into human years, this would be 15,000 years. If it is asked from what causes the sufferings of hungry ghosts arise, they arise from acting with miserliness and avarice due to their attachment to outer and inner property. As it was said in the letters to a friend, the enlightened one taught, though the sufferings experienced by hungry ghosts are various, they are of one taste. The cause is the avarice, miserliness, and ignobility of people.
Okay, and now we come to the practice section. The way to contemplate on the meaning of this is to think, alas, those born as hungry ghosts possess such a place, such conditions, and such a lifespan. If now I cannot bear the pains of thirst and hunger, even for a single day, how could I bear such sufferings as those, should I be born in that realm of the Lord of Death due to my karma and afflictions? I have no confidence that such sufferings will not befall me, since attachment and miserliness, the cause of these sufferings, arise countless times every day. Having no way to bear those sufferings, should they befall me, what shall I do? Therefore, at any cost, I must practice the true holy Dharma, which definitely prevents birth in the realm of the hungry ghosts. So that's the second of the lower realm.
You know, when I was attending this on two online sessions on the 12 links, and I was a little confused about the hungry ghosts, so I asked the Venerable, what are the hungry ghosts? And so she said, well, what do you think they're caused by? And I said, well, I would assume great attachment or heavy attachment. And she said, yeah, and some people even in a human life will have a condition where they want to eat food, but they can't swallow it. And I actually know two people. One was, his child was born with that affliction in her throat. So she was born with a narrowed throat, and she has to have go in and have it stretched out throughout her life in order for her to get food down into her stomach. Mm-hmm. The other one is a friend of mine who has a friend who developed the condition later in life where she can't swallow food. I just thought that's so interesting, how it can even manifest in a human life.
Yeah, and that's just a taste of what these poor beings experienced
exactly.
For 15,000 years. Mm-hmm. Which is shorter than a hell being, but it's still pretty long. I mean, you think about 15,000 years ago, you're going pretty far back in history to have that kind of karma. Okay, so now the third of the lower realms is the suffering of animals. As was said in the letter to a friend, even in the animal realm, those without the virtues which bring peace experience various unbearable sufferings, such as eating one another, killing, binding, beating, and the like. Laura, would you like to read that?
Sure. There are three types of animals. One, those who dwell in the outer oceans. Two, those who dwell in the darkness between the continents. And three, those who are scattered in the higher realms. One, those who dwell in the outer oceans. In the outer great oceans, there are said to be countless animals, dissimilar in name and type. Common to all of them is the suffering of stupidity and delusion, which presses down on them like a great mountain. There is the suffering of many small fish being eaten simultaneously by the large creature and the like. There is the suffering caused by many small ones penetrating the large ones and constantly eating away at them. There is the suffering of some alligators being pierced and killed by conch shells. The nagas have suffering caused by a shower of hot sands and by the garudas harming them. Common to all is the suffering of suffocation and bad smell, suffering of uncertainty and habitat and companions, the suffering of meeting foes and killers, the suffering of cold in the winter and heat in the summer, the suffering of heat by day and cold by night, and so on. The sufferings which abound for them are indescribable.
Okay, so that, thank you. So that's one category. What are nagas?
Spirits.
Hmm?
Spirits?
Yeah, what kind of spirits?
Malevolent.
Malevolent.
Not necessarily malevolent.
Yeah, nagas are very, very interesting beings. They are sometimes malevolent and sometimes beneficial and sometimes even Dharma practitioners, sometimes even very advanced. And they're said to typically have a human upper body and a snake lower body, although some of them at least have this ability to shapeshift and to turn into other forms. And the great Saint Nagarjuna, Juna means king of the Nagas, he was a great Buddhist philosopher who actually went to the Naga realm and taught them, and as a gift of gratitude, they gave him the prayer wheel, the mantra wheel, to bring back to the human realm. That's actually spiritual technology from the Naga realm. And the Naga said, well, those humans, they definitely need this, so take it back to them. Nagas are very widespread. They live in all kinds of places. Typically, they live in water bodies, but not only there. They can also live in trees in the sap because it's fluid. And I've even read that some of them even live in the air. They live for quite a long time, like many, 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 many of our lifetimes. They can be helpful and they can also be malevolent. And if you treat them badly, for example, if you foul their water, they can cause very serious illnesses and a lot of incurable diseases, so to speak, are caused by Nagas, and they actually need a spiritual remedy. That's where mantra healing and things like that come in. The regular medicine doesn't. If you go to your doctor and say, I got bad karma, can you help me? Your doctor's going to say, there's the door, then you can leave. You know? But in fact, that's the cause of many of our so-called incurable diseases or difficultly cured diseases. They're actually caused by Nagas. But on the other hand, they can also be very helpful. It's a very interesting, and they sleep a lot of the time, and then certain days they wake up. And you can make Naga offerings to appease them, but you have to do it on certain days, because if you do it while they're sleeping, it actually disturbs them and it pollutes their environment, and they're very cleanliness oriented. So you have to be very attuned to the calendar if you're going to do that kind of practice. But Nagas are sometimes actually Dharma practitioners. But they live in this sort of other realm, but sometimes they can appear to us and certain people can see them. So it's a big topic in Nagas. And what was the other one? Garudas. What are Garudas?
They're birds, huge birds, bigger than eagles, with a big beak. And they're very, very fierce. They're just about... It's hard to find an animal that could stand up to Garuda. Maybe an elephant would have a chance, but the Garudas are really powerful. They're depicted in Buddhist sculpture, and because they are also familiar with the water, they're often portrayed as a head from which water comes through their mouth, and of course that's clean. And they...
Garudas are, that's another big topic, Garudas. There's many different kinds and different colors. And sometimes enlightened beings actually manifest as Garudas. And there are the Garuda practices. And because the Nagas have a snake lower body, when they're making trouble, you can do a Garuda practice, because that kind of bird is actually the enemy of the snake, you know, just like an eagle or something. And so if you're having Naga problems, you can do Garuda practices to counteract the illness or whatever the problem is from the Nagas. So there's this kind of relationship between Nagas and Garudas, and I suspect that's why they were mentioned in the same sentence here. So that's some background on some of these creatures. I lost track of where we are. Does anybody remember?
Two.
Yeah, can somebody read that for us, please?
I can do it. Uh-huh.
The those who dwell in the darkness between continents, these animals have many sufferings. On top of the sufferings just described, they cannot even see their own outstretched or bent-in arms and legs. Due to the power of hunger and thirst, they have the suffering of not finding anything to eat except what appears right in front of them. 3. Those who are scattered in the higher realms among those animals. Among those animals who are scattered about, and those that are ownerless and that are slaughtered either by other animals or by humans or non-humans for the sake of pearls, furs, bones, flesh, skin, and the like. Those who have owners may, on top of the above sufferings, the sufferings of being enslaved, employed, bound, beaten, and finally slaughtered. Thus their sufferings are beyond conception. As it was said in the, is that the letter?
Letter to a friend.
Letter to a friend. Some die for the sake of their pearls, wool, bones, flesh, skin. Other powerless ones have their arms and legs chained and are made to serve by being prodded with iron hooks. As was said in the
Abhidharma question, yeah. Treasure of knowledge.
The longest lifespan among the beasts is 1 aeon.
Okay, so... So the animal realm is not just the animals that we see, you know, our various animals, but there's also these other animals that live in these other places that we don't necessarily see, and some of them live for really long periods of time.
But it's interesting that the animals we see suffer in this way as well.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So what's the cause? While some can live throughout 1 aeon, the short-lived die in just an instant. Since the cause of animal suffering is the ignorance of not knowing what is to be accepted and what is to be rejected, one should diligently apply oneself to the light of the teachings, which are the antidote to that ignorance. And then the contemplation part of it is, the way to contemplate on the meaning of this is to think, alas, the habitat of those beings born in the realm of animals is such, their sufferings are such, their lifespan is such, if now I cannot bear even such pains as those incurred in having to work for my own livelihood for even a single day, how could I bear such suffering if I should be born in the realm of the animals due to my karma and afflictions? I have no confidence that those sufferings will not occur to me. I have accumulated countless deeds motivated by delusions, which is the cause of the arising of this realm. Having no way to bear them, should those sufferings befall me, what shall I do at that time? Therefore, at any cost, I must practice the holy Dharma, which is able to prevent birth in the realm of animals. So, that is the conclusion of the first type of suffering, the suffering of suffering.
That's a suffering of suffering.
Of course, we also have the suffering of suffering, the famous stub your toe example, but they are focusing on these lower realms here to give us an expanded vision. I certainly didn't know all this before I started doing Lamdre. I didn't know there were other animals running around and so on. Of course, in Lamdre, we're covering this in an hour. In Lamdre, there's extensive, explanation of this. It's almost, it arrives. Yeah. So, how are we doing? Is anybody like to make a comment at this juncture about where we're at or any other relevant topic?
Well, I guess I'm just wondering kind of what the extent of acting out those bad behaviors. Like what would be a modern day example that we would know of where that individual could end up in one of these hell realms?
War.
So people who start wars go fight wars.
Yeah.
Depends on your motivation. Mm-hmm. War is certainly one of the vehicles to get you there.
Yeah, I can't think of a good motivation for war.
Self-defense.
Defense is about the only one, but it's got to be very limited.
When you're defending yourself, you're not starting a war.
Yeah.
You just want to conquer.
greed.
Dalai Lama said, if your motivation is for the greater good and it's for defense, then it's justifiable. For example, well, we know the example of Tibet. They had soldiers. Mm-hmm. I just want to reiterate what we said, I think it was last time, that you don't necessarily have to start a war to end up with really bad karma. It's this idea that it's not just one for one, but it's one for 100. Mm. If you don't purify it, it grows. That's why they use this expression, the roots. Mm-hmm. The roots of karma, or the roots of merit. It's also true for the good side of karma, too. Mm-hmm. And that's why a small good deed should never be discounted. Mm-hmm. Even just, you know, giving a little crumb to a bird or something, you know, with the right motivation. And so, you know, we think about all these horrible historical figures that started wars and did horrible things, and of course this is their karma, but also if we do something small but we don't purify it, we haven't talked about purification, but basically it's said that you should purify at the end of the day anything you did that day, because even a little thing, even a thought or a, you know, a bad word or, you know, just something that seems small needs to be taken care of, so to speak. And on the other hand, the good deeds need to be rejoiced and dedicated. Mm-hmm. So this idea of karma, I think, is, of course, it's a huge, huge topic, but there's a lot more to it than we tend to think. It isn't just, well, I did that, so that's going to happen. It has this exponentially growing characteristic to it. And also, karma is one of the knowable topics or subjects, which means only the Buddha knows all of it. And so we really need to pay attention to karma and learn as much as we can and pay attention to our behavior as a result of learning about karma. Anyway, that's all I want to say about that.
I would mention that among the Buddhists in Nepal, if there's ever a skin condition that they're afflicted with, that is automatically assumed to be because they have displeased the Nagas.
Nagas, yeah.
Skin conditions are one of the favorite punishments that they afflict people with if they have fouled their water, or if they don't give them the kind of offerings that are suited to them.
Yeah. Yeah, skin conditions, and actually Lama Zopa says that cancer is caused by Nagas. Oh. And it's very easy to foul their environment because there's so many of them, and they live, you know, in bodies of water, in trees, but also, like I said, some teachers say they live in the air or in rocks. So anytime you see a construction site or a logging site or a dam or anything to do with the environment, unless they had a ceremony done beforehand, there was probably some offense. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of spirits who do all kinds of things, but, you know, people that are kind of involved in this know that this is not just stories, that this is actually the way things are. Our perception, I mean, we don't even have the perception that a dog has for smelling, that a bird has for seeing. There are all these beings around us. There's a story where Lama Zopa was at an empowerment with one of his students, and the student was sitting next to him, and this master was giving the empowerment, and the student, I guess it was a monastic, kept, you know, flipping their robe. Lama Zopa said, "Stop flipping your robe, you're whacking the Nagas." They're here too, you know. Actually, the other day, Lama Jampa was talking about, you know, the bowls for the, you know, meditation bell, about the room is filled, you know, with Bardo beings, and they're looking for a womb, and so you need to cover objects like that. There's all these beings around us that we don't perceive, you know. that we're supposed to be working for. Mm-hmm. You know, we're supposed to be bodhisattvas, and we're whacking them with our robes and mm-hmm. cutting down their trees and polluting their homes and stuff.
So in other words, disturbing a natural environment in any way could displease the Nagas.
Certainly.
Well, I'll tell you, after that discussion we had the other day with Lama Jampo about the bowls, I do my water bowls completely different now.
Yeah.
What was the point that
Well, not to leave an empty water bowl face up.
Oh gosh, yes.
Right. Yeah. So I didn't know that, and I'd been cleaning them and putting them out, and then putting the water, and I don't do that anymore.
Yeah, but even this meditation bell, I asked him. I said, "Well, is it okay if you turn it upside down?" He said, "Well, it's okay, but it's not the best way that you should do it. You should take the little wooden stick, and if you'll see, they're now all in the bowls. They're not no longer by the side of the bell, but they're actually stuck in it." He said that's the way, that's the signal to them that it's occupied territory. So there's lots of different beings that are around us.
Well, you know, and it makes sense around the cancer thing, because medical science still doesn't know what causes cancer. So, and it's interesting, a lot of the diseases, we don't know what causes them. We know what to do with them, but we don't know what causes them, and that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, we could have a long discussion about all this. There's a type of spirit called momos, which are cause pandemics, and there are ceremonies to pacify them. There are spirits that cause epilepsy, for example. And, you know, if you think about it, there's a lot of diseases that allopathic medicine doesn't really reach.
Mm-hmm. And there's a difference between inner causes and outer causes.
Uh-huh.
If you can have the outer causes for something, but if you don't have the inner causes for it, you won't get the negative mm-hmm. effect of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, like how some people got COVID and others didn't.
Yeah. So renunciation. I think that would be a good place to pause, because it's the end of the suffering of suffering. And if we go into the suffering of change, it's quite a big topic. Mm-hmm. What do you folks think?
Sure, yeah? No, these horrors are enough for
okay. We will now do what we said we were going to do, which is dedicate our notes. Karen? May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen. But may it ever grow and flourish.
In whatever way
Valley Shri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praised as supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little merit I have gained by prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Tujichai. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.